So how's it going? By it, I mean this noble experiment we are all a part of, America. Historian Jill Lepore says in her new doorstop of a beautiful book that the founding fathers were like scientists, the founding a form of inquiry. Alexander Hamilton asking, are men really capable of establishing good government from choice, not force? Well, Jill says that her book, These Truths, almost 1,000 pages, is an attempt to answer that question. Now, she usually trains her eye on single moments or unsung characters like Benjamin Franklin's sister Jane. Her new book still does that, and every paragraph could be its own book. But These Truths includes everything from Columbus to Trump in one volume, and the through lines are clear. Ours is a country that was born in contradiction, a demand for liberty and a land of slavery. Its history looked back on through gauze. For instance, today's religious right is nostalgic for the past, but this was a country founded by radical secularists. These Truths is being praised. Conservative Andrew Sullivan writes, "We need this book." And Jill Lepore, professor of American history at Harvard, writer for The New Yorker, joins us in the studio. Welcome back and congratulations.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me, Rob.
Although I think I tore a rotator cuff.
I'm sorry to hear
book
that.
Around. Why'd you write it?
I really wanted to read it. You know, I'm like everybody else, caught up in the deal. I check the news many times over the course of the day. I get quite distracted by the latest breaking events. And even though I teach history every day, I felt as though it was hard to get enough perspective to pause long enough to really think about, you know, the sort of stretch across centuries,
the
history
arc
of whatever particular agony or whatever particular triumph was the news of the day. And I thought I shouldn't just shirk the obligation to take seriously that historians should be offering that kind of a big sweeping narrative. It's not done very often anymore.
No.
But I just thought someone has got to try, because I do think we kind of do need a book like this.
Okay, so start with the title and the problem that we've known about. It's been called America's original sin, slavery. Your book, These Truths, from We Hold These Truths to Be Self-Evident, That All Men Are Created Equal, Jefferson, Declaration of Independence. You know, I've always wondered, while hammering out the country, the founding fathers were, you know, writing the Declaration of Independence, writing the Constitution, didn't they know that their slaves were listening to them? And how is that going over? You remind us there were a lot more voices raised pointing that out at that time.
Absolutely. And that's something I knew, but even in working this, the most fun for this, writing this book for me, was finding out stuff that I hadn't known.
And I was going to ask you that.
And just things like, you know, there's this moment, I think it's in 1782, when James Madison is in Philadelphia and he's been serving in the Continental Congress and he has to go back to Virginia. And he writes to his father and he says, "I don't really know what to do, because my man Billy, this enslaved man, grown
he's known
man
since they were
Billy,
children,
that,
right?
that he's been his property since he was a child, has been living with him in Philadelphia for the whole of this time in the serving of the Congress. And Philadelphia has abolished slavery. Madison can't sell Billy. And he writes to his father, I don't want to bring him home because he knows what liberty means.
Yeah.
And he'll just convince everybody at Montpelier, the Madison plantation, to run away. And he says, like, I kind of respect that. Like, I do respect that he knows what liberty means. I, James Madison, who will go on in just a few years to draft the Constitution, I know what that means. And he decides to sort of, he places him in a position of indentured servitude, which you can do, and then it expires and he becomes a free man. He calls himself William Gardner and he marries. But he marries Thomas Jefferson's former laundress. This is a world that is dense with challenges to the seeming order of the so-called truths of the Declaration of Independence and the constitutional order.
So answer this for me. I mean, there was a guy who lived in a cave outside Philadelphia. Ben Franklin used to go visit him and sit at his feet, his potentially smelly feet, because he was kind of like a hermit, who would go around railing about how, you know, the country would pay for slavery. I mean, people were quite vocal. How did they still rationalize slavery?
A lot of those people, the people who, like Jefferson or Madison, had real moral reservations. So did, of course, George Washington, who freed his slaves in his will.
He freed his slaves when his wife, Martha, died.
Right, because they were mainly his wife.
And she was afraid she was going to be murdered.
And so she had to free them. But it's not that generation that really defends the institution of slavery. They all, many of them think it is dying a natural death. Because in fact, the slave population is declining at that time. And because slavery has been abolished in New England and for the most part in the middle colonies, they don't think it's going to survive, and they think that the Union can't survive if it is abolished.
Right, they won't get the Southerners.
So they decide that the Union Union is more important to them. It's not until the 1830s that there's this so-called positive good argument, where Southerners begin saying, no, not only do we think slavery is not bad, we think slavery is good. And you get this kind of John C. Calhoun, this whole rhetoric of race.
Look, I mean, there's so it's impossible to do anything but dip our toe in this here, because there's so much. But the Washington Post writes in their review, you do something in this book better than any other comprehensive history of the United States, which is writing the lives of slaves into the story of the Republic. And so, you know, we recommend it just on that. But you say you learned something. The joy of reading this is that you think you know history and you don't. I knew the Salem witches were not witches, but you write that for Mercy Short, one of them, the assumption now is that her witchcraft was a PTSD from an Indian capture 2 years earlier. Her parents, her siblings murdered in front of her in New Hampshire. She was forced to walk to Canada. Along the way, she saw a five-year-old chipped to pieces, a young girl scalped, another captive burned at the stakes. I knew Washington willed his slaves to be freed after his wife died. I knew that, but I didn't know on his deathbed there were more blacks gathered there than whites. I knew one of his slaves, a woman, ran away to New Hampshire. Actually, there's a book about her. But I didn't know that when Washington sent a hunter to get her, he sent a message back, look, I'm not going to bring her back. People like her. They're going to be upset. These little details. Tell us more about ones that maybe you didn't know.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I would say, too, that the reason I put all that stuff in there is historians in the academy understand how you can't understand the larger story of American politics absent those histories of race and absent experiences of women.
Women, yeah.
But still in textbooks, there's sort of like there's the main line narrative, which is like president to president to president. And then there are these sort of like call out boxes. And here's what's going on with women. Mm-hmm. And here's what's going on with black people. And here's what's going on with immigrants. As if those things aren't all happening at the same time. And imagine if someone tried to explain our world by, having a chapter that was about the Trump presidency and then having a few sidebars that were about Black Lives Matter or were about
the
white
wall.
Nationalism mm-hmm. or were about building the wall or were about DACA. Like, his presidency is part of these tensions and also America's place in the world. So what I tried to do, and it's hard because you have these larger-than-life characters of the presidents. We know so much about them. Andrew Jackson leaps off the page. But I tried to pick characters who could deliver the other piece of the story because they happen to be also good characters that you could really imagine. You could see them on the page.
Yeah. Andrew Jackson leaps off the page, much like Donald Trump will when historians are writing about him. Do you think, as some are saying, that populist president is the one that Trump might most resemble?
I'm not particularly persuaded mm-hmm. by that. I guess there are some things that leap out. I mean, Jackson's entire cabinet basically resigned. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of turmoil in the Jackson White House, and he was beloved by the people that elected him and quite despised by Washington insiders. So there are the occasional similarities. But the real energy of the Jackson presidency was the democratization of American politics. And it's quite thrilling to see how people that for the first time have the vote, poor people, poor white men who are enfranchised for the first time, support Jackson and believe that he has delivered to them the things that he promised he would deliver to them. I don't think we see that with the Trump presidency quite.
I mean, I'm going to skip a little forward through history because it's all here. There's ACT UP, the AIDS activists during the Reagan administration when a president wouldn't even say the word AIDS. There's Phyllis Schlafly, leading this conservative movement in the 1970s in her opposition to equal rights. There's Bill and Hillary Clinton, Obama, there's Trump.
So someone like Schlafly I spend a lot of time with. I think even, frankly, historians of conservatism who are themselves conservative maybe haven't given Schlafly enough credit because she's a woman, but I really do think she is chiefly the most important architect of the modern conservative movement, and that a lot of what we understand as polarization in the contemporary world is really about the failure of the ERA and its long repercussions. But the purpose of that is giving people the opportunity to debate those questions.
Yeah. As we said, you start off by saying there were questions that were asked by the founding fathers, almost like investigators or scientists. Here's an experiment. How will this turn out? How has it turned out? I mean, we're reminded that there was a time when the seams did not hold. I mean, the horror of the Civil War. What's your answer? Can we do this?
What gives me the most concern right now is that there's always been a way when there have been problems with the design. There's always been a way to fix it. But we are now in a situation where our political arrangements have been automated, where polarization that was built by political consultants who wanted to, you know, polarize this electorate about that and polarize these people about that. Now that is done by machine. Now it is very difficult to escape the polarized conditions in which we live because it's not even manually done any longer. That's what gives me the most concern.
And by that you mean through the machine that you talk about throughout the book and what it is in modern day, the internet, the automatic attacks on us all the time.
The way social media constructs political communities, reinforces political boundaries, social boundaries. It doesn't connect people. It divides them.
Yeah. Jill Lepore, her new book is These Truths, A History of the United States. Almost 1,000 pages. Jill, thanks so much for writing it and for talking to us about it.
Thank you so much.